Hi folks, and welcome along to this week's episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman, and my weekly dive into the world, the wonderful, beautiful, inspiring world of music and video. I say video, just a moving image really. It could be film, it could be TV, and games sometimes as well. But I just wanted to, it's so funny, I just started watching The Bear this week, which I know, it doesn't matter, I say this all the time when it comes to music, film, or actually, it doesn't matter when you come to it, if you come to it at some point and you get a reaction and it makes you feel a certain way, then it's a good thing. There is no expiry date on art. That's what I feel anyway. So anyway, I started watching The Bear, obviously addicted to it, just finished the first season, about to start on the second. And then I've also been watching Boiling Point. Now, you might have watched the film that came out, must be 2 years ago now, starring the brilliant Stephen Graham as the kind of lead chef in it. It was filmed in kind of real time, one shot. Crazy thing. I think they did it in COVID as well, if I remember rightly. It was an extraordinary film, really kind of, I think, because of that notion of the way they filmed it, as well as the environment they filmed in, you really felt that tension and that heat of a kitchen. So I've been lucky enough that it's been adapted into a TV show that's coming to our screens very soon. And I was given the luxury of watching the first two episodes, and it is brilliant. It takes the story on from where the film leaves off. That's all I can say really. But I feel like I've been on a bit of a kind of culinary tip when it comes to my viewing at the minute. So I also wanted to draw your attention in a kind of triple whammy way to a little Thai film that's up on Netflix called Hunger, which kind of tells the story of this young girl who runs a kind of street food cafe and is kind of pushed to explore her limits, I guess, within the culinary world. It's so good. And I just thought I would draw your attention to it. So The Bear, Boiling Point, and Hunger. If you are not feeling hungry already, you will be after you watch one or any of those. But we've got loads of great stuff coming up on the show over the next couple of weeks. I'm going to be talking to Volker Bertelmann, who we last spoke to with Edward Berger about their collaboration on the multi-award winning All Quiet on the Western Front. Volker's got a new album out of his own original music, which we talk about amongst many, many other things, including All Quiet, reflecting on those Oscar and BAFTA wins, and also working on Black Mirror and a number of other things. It's been so nice over the last couple of weeks, particularly really celebrating British independent film. We've talked about Clockenleuder at Mercy Falls. We're going to be talking about Ballywalter in a couple of weeks as well, which is a beautiful little Irish film. And then also an extraordinary documentary that's coming out on the 6th of October called 20 Days in Mariupol. This might be one of the hardest things I've ever had to watch, but I think one of the most important things. So I really want to try and get as many of you to watch this film as possible. The title of the film kind of tells you exactly what's going on. 20 Days in Mariupol, it's coming out on the 6th of October. And we're going to be talking to Jordan Dijkstra, who's the composer of the film. It's brilliant. And we're continuing, actually, just quickly as well, Haunting in Venice, which is coming out in cinemas on Friday. We're going to be talking about that on next week's episode, but more on that at the end of the show. But we're continuing with our celebration of independent British films on Soundtracking this week with our latest guest, who is the phenomenal Charlotte Regan. She's the writer director of a film called Scrapper. Scrapper is outstanding. It's been in cinemas for a couple of weeks. It's still in cinemas. Please go and see it. Please support Charlotte and her brilliant team and independent film, and you will leave the cinema feeling rewarded. And your life will be enriched from watching this film. So it's still in cinemas, and I'm so grateful to Charlotte for responding to my random DMs on Instagram and finding the time to chat to me this week. The film features a remarkable central performance by a young lady called Lola Campbell, who is 11 years old. And the film tells the story of Lola's character, Georgie, who is forced to confront a new domestic reality for a number of reasons, but one of those is when her estranged dad turns up. So that's all I'm going to say, because you need to be in the film, experience it to just fully enjoy it. Now, the film's scored by Patrick Johnson, who I've got to say huge thanks to Patrick, because he was so kind to share some of his as yet unreleased cues for the film. And so we'll begin with one of them. This is Chase. ¶¶ Charlotte, welcome to Soundtrack. And listen, I've got to say thanks so much for responding to my bonkers DMs on Instagram. I really appreciate it. Congratulations on this film. It's brilliant. And I hope you don't mind, but I wanted to start by asking what you wanted to achieve when you originally started writing it.
I don't know. I think I always wanted to make like a working class film that was like joyful. And I know there are lots, like I love Shane's films and I love so many of them films, but I think I just always like watched a lot growing up and been like, oh, like I want to see the joy that I remember growing up, which is like playing out. And like when you're a kid, you don't know that you have less than anyone. Do you know what I mean? So you're just like, your world is the only world and it's the best world. It's only when you move into like middle-class film spaces that you're like, oh, maybe it was a bit different. So yeah, I think it started with that. But to be honest, the story, it changed. It started as like a teenage boy and his nan on the run from gangsters. And it was much more like shootouts, like Guy Ritchie-esque. God knows where the story came from. I think my producer Theo was probably like, oh, that is flipping expensive, isn't it? What's that, the full shootout in 10 pages, Charlie? So it was probably, probably cheapening it down.
Was finding Lola, was she part of that journey then? Because, you know, in terms of this little firecracker and what she's sort of brings to Georgie, this character, talk to me a little bit about that journey and about how, I guess, how her energy, performance, presence informed, did it inform much the film and where the story went?
Yeah. Lola's just like the best human in the entire world. And I say one of my best friends, but it's like that TikTok trend where you say they're your best friend and then you ask them and they're like, yeah, it's nice for you, but you're not one of mine. Yeah, it's very much that vibe. But she's just incredible. Like I always say this and I don't ever mean it as a joke. Like she probably should have been given like half of my writer's fee and like a co-writer, co-director credit, because the creative impact she had on the project as a whole is mad. And I think one day she's going to like write and direct a film that is 10 times better than any of our films. Do you know what I mean? She's just like an incredible human. But Shaheen, our casting director, Shaheen Baig, is incredible at finding street cast kids in particular. And Lola sent in a self-tape just chatting pure rubbish about Home Bargains instead of doing anything I'd asked her to do. She just was talking about how Home Bargains is a much better shop than B&M, which is like a fair opinion. I back it. And whether or not it needed a 5-minute video dedicated to it is another thing, but you know, we'll run with it. Then she came to the audition and kind of wouldn't really say anything. She's quite you can't like buy her a Twix and she's your mate, you know, it takes a long time to win her over. She's very suspicious, as we all should be. So me and Theo, the producer, started going to her house for cups of teas like once a week for months until she like deemed us worthy of friendship. I'm still unsure if she has. We went to like Legoland a few months ago. So I'm like, are we friends? No, logic. I'm playing it cool, but I think we're friends, isn't it? Yeah.
You created an environment for her with your team, with your collaborators and stuff that made her feel safe. You created a safe and creative playground for her. If you hadn't done that, you wouldn't, this, like you say, that trust wouldn't be there for her to give that performance and to embody this character and to take this character. So that's, down to you and your team as well, Charlotte, you know, in terms of, I know you're not good with compliments. That's important.
I think Lola's level, you know, like the hierarchy of needs thing, like, is it Maslow's hierarchy of needs? Lola's my top one is like Greg's and McDonald's. And then it's trust and a good environment. You know what I mean? So as long as you're ordering her Greg's and McDonald's every morning, you're fine. Her in the future, that is the key. Okay. Don't take weeks to figure it out like we did. Just get that Greg's on tap from day one, no matter where you are. You've got to get the sausage rolls coming in at 7 a.m.
Yeah. I've got a 10-year-old. So I know that if I want him to do anything, a McDonald's milkshake is the key to unlock the world, basically. He will literally, he'll wash the car, he'll do anything for a McDonald's milkshake, maybe six nuggets as well. Do you know what I mean? Oh man, there's so much I want to talk to you about. But when it came to the look of the film as well, I love the like the colouring, the aesthetic of it, like that flare at the start, the painted walls, the way she throws that black bin in that bin at the start and stuff. I mean, all those things tell you before a word is uttered, tells you a lot about atmosphere, emotion, all that kind of stuff as well. It's just, I just wondered in terms of when you went into making the film, in terms of script and storyboarding and finding your palette and all that kind of stuff, Did you go in with a really kind of clear idea of that, in terms of what you wanted the film to feel like, to look like?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, obviously, it's made better by all, like, once you start getting all the incredible HODs on, then my ideas that, like, my £1 million for one page ideas have suddenly become achievable because someone's like, don't be silly, Charlie. Like, that's a dumb idea, but here's the way we can do it. So, yeah, like, to an extent, for sure. I think me and Molly, my DP, is like absolute icon. Her film just like won at Cannes. She's just like a creative legend, absolute icon. We came up through music videos, so I think we always kind of had that very like music video taste to everything. And in music videos, it's like such a like playground of creativity, like music videos, you just do what you want to create an incredible image or a connection. No one's there being like, oh, but the continuity and what does it mean for the story? No one ever said like music. It's just like dash whatever you want it. So I think a lot of it came through that. We'd sit down with a script and be like, how can we make this more music video-y? And because we're probably both like super restless and low attention, so we were just like, how can we make this fun and really stress the producer Theo out by doing something stylized that's going to make no sense for the story arcs? So it was like a combo of that, and all the people around, like Oliver, the costume designer, and Eleanor, my production designer, all kind of came on board to that like working class joy that we were trying to do, and that came part with everything. We kept saying if it like pisses down of rain, there's only so much even Molly Manning Walker herself can do with a lens change or whatever. So the painting the houses, I was super like into from the start. Obviously stressed Theo out, but joyful, isn't it? A great time.
It is though. It's that kind of look. Like, I remember, and it's so interesting as well, sort of a kind of child's perspective on grief as well. It's such a beautiful story to tell, I think, as well. It's one of the main themes of the film for me, anyways. Like I remember I was 7 and my cousin was 8 and she died, and kind of having that first of not really understanding it, and not really understanding that she physically wasn't going to be there anymore, sort of thing. And being sort of almost kind of protected by the adults around you of kind of not talking about things and about, but all you wanted to do was talk about it really and kind of to ask questions and things like that, and also finding humor in dark times. And I think that that's a real working class thing as well in terms of how humor is a tool. It's a handy thing to have that can help in so many ways as well. And then was the tone something that was really important to you about the film, in terms of kind of finding that balance about the two things, really?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's the thing we like grappled with the most in the edit. It's what made our edit so tricky. I think it's like a hard one to kind of manage, especially with like someone as unconfident with writing and stuff as I am. I've not done anything before other than shorts, so it's that childlike perspective that helped. I think like similar to your experience, I've always found that actually as kids we are like much more in touch with emotions like grief. And I think kids actually can, because you don't have that filter. It's the adults kind of are like, don't talk about that, don't go into that space and talk about that. And I found when we were writing the film, that was like what me and Theo were drawn to and kind of researching. I like lost my dad and my nan as I was writing, and I found like all these
I'm
adult
sorry.
books about grief, like take it into such an intellectual and academic space, and it's a feeling. And actually when you kind of speak to kids who have experienced different things, not always grief but just different emotions, they're so much more willing to be present. And it's kind of like it feels like a language that we unteach them, if you know what I mean. Especially in the UK where we're like, oh, don't talk about that, don't talk about that, that's not a good subject. It's like we're like they start in quite a good place and are very capable of having them conversations, and then we slowly teach ourselves to like not have them and to shut that sides of our brains and our emotions off. So I think that was where the tone come from. And then it was honestly is like I think Lola really carried the tone on her shoulders. Like poor Lola carried the whole film on her shoulders. Like what a challenge for a bloody 11-year-old on like
11. Oh my God.
11. Yeah. So it was Lola. She has such a way of like, which I do find is a working class kid thing. She's like so mature yet so immature, if you know what I mean. Like she has that balance of you can sit down and have the most like adult professional conversation with her, and then suddenly it'd be like, oh, there's a pack of Haribo over there, and it's like, oh, cool. We were just having a really serious chat, Lola. But do you want to just, yeah. Or you give her like a water pistol, and suddenly she's just shooting. Harrison Allen for hours, and you're like, Lola, please chill out. Like, we've got to do the film. So it's just, yeah, she carried it totally, definitely.
How much of the script was kind of there, and how much did you allow her to kind of play? Because there's so many scenes I could talk about, you know, like when they're robbing the bank. Do you want me to be honest? You know, when they're sort of saying about they're testing people's bikes and all that. It's so great. And then who, you know, that whole thing about who said you could use the washing machine, come on, do your job properly, all that kind of stuff. To then that really kind of like, I didn't think I needed you, when he says about Cuddle and she's like, I don't know, I need someone, and all that stuff. I mean, there's so many great lines and conversations and reactions. And was all that written down? And did you give her a bit of freedom to react, I guess, and be the character and respond, I guess?
Yeah, like she had, her and Alan in particular, had all the kind of freedom in the world. Like, and Lola in particular is like incredible at improv. Like, she can talk pure rubbish for hours and hours. Like, it's sensational kind of levels of skills she's got there. But yeah, it was a mix. We gave them the script beforehand, but then I didn't like them to obsess over the script. I very much like wanted to have a shorthand. So I was like, this is the scene where this happens. But beyond that, you do you. Do you know what I mean? Especially because of their age, you know, as much as we all wish we still are in touch with our childlike selves and can speak like a 12-year-old or 11-year-old, like if you actually read my dialogue. And words become uncool so quickly. They every day would be like, no, Charlie, you can't say that anymore. That's not a cool word. And I'd be like, oh, it was a year ago. Like, what's happened, lads? It's so quick. So yeah, she did tons of improv. Her and Harris were great at improv as well. And sometimes we had to put a ban on improv because she would kind of intentionally, she hated the emotional scenes. So yeah, she would take them into like really dark places. She had this big improv story about a spider that lived in the corner, and it was a grandma, and it had a collection of kitchen knives. I think it was like a serial killer on the estate, you know. So she goes quiet sometimes. You gotta be like, that, save that for like your first horror film. It's not for this film, Lola. Yeah.
That's amazing. Oh god, kids' imagination, isn't it the best thing ever? When it came to music though, you know, you've got that kind of that brilliant sort of kick in with the streets, turn the page, and then the music's so, it's not sparse, but it's not over. There's not loads of music in there. But when it does come in, and when it's there, when Patrick scores there, it's kind of, the blend is so beautiful. Like, you know, there's so much beautiful atmospheric noise going around the film, you know, from the estate and all that kind of stuff, and the bikes and all that kind of thing. The cues sometimes can kind of come in and you don't even realise sometimes. So beautifully and subtly and brilliantly mixed and weaved in. What was your kind of thought process coming in with regards to music and how you wanted to play with music and use music in the film?
Patrick, I've been working with like since one of my first projects. I've not really worked with other composers, and he's like one of my best friends in the world. And he's actually someone who admit that I am one of his best friends. It's not like a Lola situation where I'm calling them not my best friend, but they're not. I swear Patrick is one of my best friends, I promise. Because I've always found I can't massively talk about music in a way that isn't like instinctual or emotional, and he is just brilliant at translating that. Sometimes I think he's stitched me right up, because if I ever have to work with another composer, I'll go in and I'll be like, it's, you know, a bit sad but a bit happy, and they'll be like, what, like, you flipping like. So Patrick is just incredible. I think with everything, like the script, we always said the script is like Georgie has kind of wrote it, you know, a year after something has happened. The script is meant to feel like it is her retelling of a story, and kids naturally embellish, and the everything had to come from that. So the cinematography, the style, and the score as well. So Patrick was very much like trying to ground it in like the chaos of like an 11-year-old's mind, who is happy when they've had Haribo and sad when they're not, you know. So it all kind of came from that like thought process of how can we make this kind of childlike and experiment with it. And he is naturally so like subtle, and I don't mean that in a bad way at all. Like, he just really like lets the scenes have their space, and like likes music to like kind of almost creep up on you. Like some of the cues, I kind of forget that they're in there until suddenly they hit me, and then I'm like, oh, Patrick, you are an icon. What a...
it's also that kind of those worlds, that the different worlds that there are within the film. You know, there's the real world, and then there's the kind of perspective of, you know, the dreamlike world or whatever it is. And that, I think, really complements what he's done with that as well, in terms of how the music can take you into those moments as well as kind of visually.
Yeah, no, and he's like very much a obsessive world person. Like, as soon as we kind of mentioned the scrap metal tower into the sky, you know, he was delving into that and like was determined to find a way to make like metal sound emotional. So he's very much like into that approach, and into kind of meeting people that are part of the project. And he's very like, you know, if you start a script 2 years before you start shooting, it will be Patrick who is calling you, chasing you, like, should we just sit in the studio for a day? And I'm like, Patrick, we're like 3 years off of a green light here, lad. Like, let's chill out, innit? And he's like, but it'd just be fun, innit, to kick some ideas about. So yeah, he's incredible, and he is very much like into it from back in the day. Yeah.
Does that feed back into you though, then, if you are having those kind of chats with him way ahead of a, you know, of a camera rolling or being on set or whatever, does that feed then into kind of to where you are in the pre-production of the film?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I wouldn't really like call Patrick the composer of the film. I would like call him like a mad essential collaborator. Like, we were going on in lockdown, we would like sit at the Emirates Stadium for like 3-4 hours at a time, just talking about what was making us sad for the day and different floors. He's like, and how that kind of connects to music. Like, Patrick is like one of the most like emotionally intelligent people I've ever met. And I've always thought like composing is such a mix of having to be so incredibly emotionally intelligent and capable of having those conversations, as well as technically incredible. And he kind of mixes the two. So from even script writing stage, you know, even the conversations with him about grief and about emotions like feed into the script. And I think that's the process with like everyone who's a part of it. You know, like Molly's one of my best friends, and we were chatting about it so early. Theo, my producer, very much all feeds in, and it's like everyone's film. That way, if it does terribly, get to blame them all. You know what I mean? You know, you're all part of it as well, lad.
it kill you not having her wearing an Arsenal shirt?
Yeah. Devastating. West Ham, isn't it? Absolutely. I feel like Arsenal didn't get back to us, but also Oliver liked the colours of West Ham, obviously. I can't tell you. Arsenal's a bit red, isn't it? A bit mad on screen, but yeah.
Oh, West Ham and cheese, as my 10-year-old calls them. That's it. Killing you like that. Ugh. We've got a mate staying with us at the minute, actually, who's is he a Spurs fan? And my husband's Arsenal, and he wouldn't drink his cup of tea out of his Arsenal mug this morning. It's like, that. Come on, it's got a bit far. Come on.
It's quite far, yeah. I love that, though. I rate it. Yeah.
What about the Streets track? Was that kind of something you found, you know, in terms of that being the, you know, it's the first piece of music we hear. So yeah, talk me through kind of deciding on that. Was there a journey of what that was going to be, or was it always going to be that, or?
It was almost always going to be that, really, even in really early drafts. I mean, in a hopeful way, obviously, until like Amazing Music Supervisor came on board, we didn't know if we would actually get the permission on our epically like low music budget or whatever. But it always, like, the Streets music always summed up like working class childhood and kind of that dark humour that comes out of those worlds to me. Like, you know, like playing it on like a tinny, like Walkman or whatever, when you're coming back from school, those tracks have just always really, yeah, just been that for me and represented like such a period of time. So kind of from early, and I just love the energy of that track. It was always written in.
That's it. Turn the page on the day, walk away. Cause there's sense in what I say. I'm 45th generation Roman, but I don't know or care when I'm spitting. So return to your sitting position and listen, it's fitting. And I'm miles ahead and they chase me. Show your face on TV, then we'll see. You can't do half, my crew laughs at your rhubarb and custard verses. You rain down curses, but I'm waving your hearses driving by. Streets riding high with the beats in the sky. All stare, eyes glazed, garage burned down, the fire raged. For 40 days and in 40 ways. But through the blaze they see it fade. The sea of black, the beaming heat on their faces. Then a figure emerges from the wastage, eyes transfixed with a piercing gaze. One hand clutching his sword, raised to the sky. They wonder how, they wonder why. The sky turns white, it all becomes clear. They felt lifted from their fears. They shed tears in the light after six dark years. Young bold soldiers, the fire burns, cracks and smoulders. 5 years older and wiser, the fires are burning on fire. Never tire, slay warriors in the forests and on higher. We sing.
We got permission and we were going to use Dry Your Eyes, mate, as well, because there was going to be this big epic story where the Spiders were having a divorce and things like that. But it was I don't know why I was doing it. I was just like going a bit mad. And Dry Your Eyes was going to be like the divorce track, but, and I would have been so hyped to, I love that track, but then yeah,
she'd do an alternative video for him for that.
Yeah, I think he'd love that. I'm sure he'd really love that. Yeah. I'll reach out, I'll DM him.
Mike! Yeah. Yeah. You know, in terms of that background of music videos as well, do you have a kind of, when you think about making music videos, is there one that really springs to mind as being the kind of, you know, a really great experience that, I don't know, you found really inspiring, that was kind of like, oh yeah, this is a great experience. This is, I'm learning a lot from this to kind of take forward.
I don't know, like I really loved, like I miss the kind of organic feeling of like turning up to like grime videos, and you can have a plan, but look, if that rapper don't want to go with your plan, then you're not going with it. Do you know what I mean? Or sometimes they'll be like, oh no, like I've got my trainers are looking a bit mad, and then bang, you're waiting 2 hours whilst we all go and get new trainers, even though there's no full body shot in the video. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, just that in general really teaches you to kind of roll with the chaos and remind yourself that everything is like not that deep. As long as like Lola and Alan are happy on set, then it's not that deep. I mean, it's cool, I love film, but when we're making a film and it's a privilege and it's sick. So I think music videos help you with that. I can never remember a particular one. I think I always, this is like the, no, it's not uncool, but I should like reference a cool grind video, but I'm always like the, I did a Mumford and Sons video and I got to meet like loads of horses. Meet them is the wrong word, isn't it? But it felt like a meeting.
They're living things. So you met them. Yeah, totally.
It'd been strictly kind of donkey rides on the like red car seafront until then. So I was pretty hype about the horses, about filming horses. I felt like I was doing like an epic Jane Austen vibe That was a great time. Yeah.
Western next. That's what you need to do. Western. Yeah. Totally.
Tell Theo, because he is suppressing my expensive ideas on the day.
I'll DM him. One of the scenes that's kind of had a really lovely life on, you know, on social media is the dancing scene with the two of them and stuff. And it's such a beautiful kind of moment and a really pivotal point as well, like in their relationship and in the journey of those characters as well. Did you have music on set? Did you play music on set at all in and around that or at any point on the film?
No, not massively. It was a dance that Lola and Alan had been teaching all the crew because they used to go off at lunch and do like TikTok dances, which is like everyone now. I didn't know it was such a thing. Me and Theo are trying to get on it, but we're not quite as like looking as good. So that came from Lola. That scene in the hangar was very much like we filmed semi-chronologically in that as their Harris and Lola's relationship in real life developed, so did the on-screen one. And that was our last scene on our last ever day. And by then, Lola trusted him. She was very suspicious of him till then. Not for a reason. Obviously, he's a lovely man, great human being, very selfless. But on that day, they were like the best of friends and they'd reached kind of the height of their friendship. So it was very much like, we're just going to film and you guys do like absolutely whatever you want. And yeah, they really were very magical. I think she'd been trying to teach Harris that dance for most of the shoot as well. So she's just using it in her favor, I think. Yeah.
His reaction to her throughout the film, I think, is just kind of pitch perfect for that character. It's incredible growth of chemistry for those characters. I think it's brilliant. I think he's played it just so great. Really brilliant.
Yeah, he's a gem. Great human.
Yeah.
Very dodgy haircut that he ran and dyed himself before starting the film and like absolutely enraged the hair and makeup designer.
No!
He's like, it's something Jason would do in it. Yeah, so very much took that character on. But yeah, Harris is a legend. He was so, like, I can't imagine another actor giving as much to the young people as he did. You know, he would like hang about when he didn't have scenes just to help them out. He would make bad coffee, like where the gritty bits were still in it. But it's the effort. It's the effort. Do you know what I mean? We appreciate the effort that we
He showed up. I love that. I loved your watch list that you did, which I thought was an amazing collection of films. And the Paris, Texas thing as well. I love that, of the kind of in the little nods to that in the film as well, with the cars and stuff. And also just in terms of, weirdly, like the emotional thing of like Harold's moving castle as well. I felt like there was a kind of, I love that film. I watched that film so many times with my kids as well. It's such a great story. I kind of almost get something more from it every time I watch it. It's kind of like the gift that keeps on giving in a way as well. But Baby Teeth was another one, Shannon Murphy's film, that I thought was kind of beautiful reference and reminded me of that. And I remember chatting, I lucky enough to get Shannon on the podcast actually to talk about Baby Teeth, because I thought that, what was it about that film in particular, Charlotte, that you really kind of connected with, you enjoyed?
Well, I think it was the cast and like the kind of rawness to their performances. And I don't know, I think I love, like, I'm like pretty, not low end, but like I'll go to all the box office bangers, you know. I'm like all about the Bourne Ultimatums, seen Oppenheimer way too many times already. I'm like,
have you?
Yeah.
How many times?
3 times we're on now, which is a good time, isn't it? And me and Patrick are going to do a fourth because he's not watched it proper. He's like, watched it once in like not IMAX and then another time it was really dubbed in Spanish. I'm like, bro,
what?
What are you doing, Patrick? You're ruining the movie experience of the decade. Like, you need to go center IMAX it. So
yeah, at the Science Museum. That's where I saw it.
I've not done Science Museum. I've only done that one. Is the Science Museum?
The IMAX. Yeah, Science Museum IMAX is sit right under the projector, and then you hear the ticking of the projector, and it's like it almost levitates you before the film even starts. It's amazing.
Okay, magic. Yeah, we're going to book. But yeah, it's just, I love stuff where like Baby Teeth is, I think we always spoke about like the characters in Scrapper, they start out flawed and they end flawed. And I think Baby Teeth does something similar. Like Shannon's not trying to say, Like, these characters are gonna be brilliant. They've done a 180 on all their flaws. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think everyone, like the parents in particular in that, are still, you know, they're struggling with their flaws and they forever will be. And they've slightly admitted what their flaws have done to each other's relationships. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's something about that. And then just the cast, like, I just think they're just next level. Like, I feel like I'm like watching like the most beautifully shot like documentary almost. There's just something about it that made me like really fall into, I just loved it so much.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant as well. I'm glad you mentioned Arrival. It reminded me to watch that again. What's next? Do you know what's next?
What is next in life? I'm going to play basketball today.
Wicked.
Nice times.
Me time. I like it. Yeah.
Cooking a little, cooking a salad. You wouldn't say the word cooking, chopping a salad, doesn't it?
Depends if you're putting chicken in it or something. It's like,
no, just straight up chopping a salad. But work wise, I don't know.
What do you want to do?
I want to do like Born Ultimatum.
Yes!
I want to do like a Born Ultimatum. I want to do like Christopher Nolan vibes. Like, obviously aiming very high. And my friend Fraser is always like, oh, big aims there. But you know, you got to, I just love cinema where I go in and I feel like that's what Oppenheimer was to me. I was like, this is what like cinema should be. I was like, I just feel like I come out buzzing. Like, it's just incredible. Like the same with like Barbie and Arrival and just films like that that are like such an experience. So I think I want to make those kind of films one day, obviously, and then wherever the paycheck is biggest, you know, trying to create that generational wealth. So all of the money.
I remember when I did the whole Barbenheimer, and I did Barbie and then I did Oppenheimer the same day, and saw Oppenheimer at the Science Museum. It didn't feel like, was it 3 hours or something? Or it didn't feel that long at all. I seriously could have gone straight back in and watched it again, sort of thing. It was like, oh, I love the worlds that he and many other filmmakers make. But yeah, I'd love to see you do something like Born. That would be amazing. Oh my God. Yeah, totally. Before I let you go and stop throwing compliments your way, can you give me a recommendation of something that people should either watch, listen to, read, see, whatever it is, like the last thing culturally that's really like kind of connected with you?
Oh God, the pressure. I gotta like,
it's all right, no rush,
gotta bang out the Letterboxd. You know, the Letterboxd, love a bit of Letterboxd. Are you about Letterboxd?
I'm getting into Letterboxd. I'm a late comer, but as I say with all things, music, film, whatever it is, it doesn't matter when you come to it, so long as you come to it.
Yeah. Okay, nice. Letterboxd is a great time. There's How on the old top four, innit? You can't.
Oh yeah,
love How. What did I watch? I watched the first Slam Dunk the other day, which was like, I'm obsessed with basketball, so the combination of basketball, anime, and the tickets were free because Picture House have given us these cool cards where we get to go to. I guess you have this already, innit? You've got one of these. I feel like you have these cool cinema tickets for free all the time, innit?
No.
Don't lie. Of course
you I'm not lying. I'm emailing as we
the first thing they said when they gave it to me, don't tell people about this. And I think I've mentioned it on five things so far.
Is it like the equivalent of a Nando's black card?
Yes, so sick. It's like the best gift I've ever been given in my life. And I will see everything twice, three times. And there's one down the road from me. So they've stitched themselves right up because I'm cost them a fortune. But the first Slam Dunk was a banger. It's like a high school basketball team. And I felt like I was watching a live basketball game. Animated.
I'm just looking up it now. My 15-year-old's massively into anime and manga, and he just got us watching Monster. I don't know if you've watched Monster. Oh, my God, it's like 64 episodes. Like, each episode's about 20, and it's quite an old anime, but it's the storytelling in it is, the characters and it's phenomenal. It's so great. I'm like kind of just like being really rude when I should be doing stuff where I'm like that. What, you do nothing? I'm just watching another episode of Monster kind of on the sly sort of thing. But Slam Dunk, okay, that's a great shout. Do you play professionally?
Come on, boss. I'm absolutely shocking. Just love basketball. It's such a joy, such a great time. And then Molly's film, How to Have Sex. Yes.
Yes!
Film of the year, film of the following year. film of my life, 10 out of 10, epic. So that is what everyone should watch for sure.
I'm going to see that next week.
Nice.
Yeah! I love it. Charlotte, listen, thank you for responding to my crazy DM and coming on and chatting and dealing with the uncomfortableness of having compliments thrown your way, because you deserve them. And I'm so excited what's next. And thank you for your time.
Anna, thank you for having me. And
yeah. Yeah, you too. Have fun shooting some hoops. Do they still say that, or have we passed that? They do? Okay, great. Bye, darling. See you later. Bye. Johnson Score to Scrapper, that's Hanger Dance Off. And we are going to get Patrick on the podcast to talk about his brilliant score, hopefully around the time that the film's going to be out on home entertainment. But the film is still in cinema, so make sure you get along to see it. And that rounds off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the brilliant Charlotte Regan. My huge thanks to Charlotte for taking the time to talk to us. As I've already said multiple times, Scrapper is out in cinemas now. Please get along to see it at your local cinema. It is a brilliant film, and I cannot wait to see what she does next. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with our back catalogue. We're fastly approaching 400 episodes with some of the biggest names in the business and plenty of newcomers like Charlotte. Follow us on socials. We're at Soundtracking UK, and we also have a YouTube channel, which would be great if you could subscribe to. And just before talk about next week's guest, and talking of socials and things like that, if you are a regular to this podcast, you'll know that we're very transparent, and we started this podcast back in August 2016, Ben and I, and it kind of just still is Ben and I, to be honest. Needless to say, a lot has changed since we launched the podcast, and one of those is the kind of rise and growth of social media and how important that side of things can be to getting the word out, particularly for little independent podcasts like ourselves. We don't have, you know, kind of big corporations, big advertising, all that kind of thing to get behind us, and have massive billboards here, there and everywhere. So we really do rely on you guys, word of mouth and that kind of thing. So we're looking to expand the team, and we're looking for someone to work part-time on our socials. So someone who is kind of really up to speed on, I guess, all the social platforms that are out there, who's got great editing skills, who's got a real kind of flair for trying to do things a little bit differently, but more importantly, I think as well, or as important, I should say, is a real passion for film, because we've got, as I said, almost 400 episodes that we kind of want to dip into to remind people of the wonderful guests that we've had on the show. So yeah, if you're interested, or you know someone who might well be up for working with us on the podcast, we have put the job ad is up on a platform called Dots, or you can email me info@edithbowman.com if you're interested in being part of the team. Send us your CV and yeah, we'll be in touch. Thanks very much. Now, next up, we are thrilled to welcome back Oscar winner, multi-award winner, I should say, the composer Hilda Gudnottier, who we last spoke to on the podcast for her phenomenal score for Joker. A lot has happened since we had that conversation, but she's here to talk about her latest film, which is A Haunting in Venice. And it's Kenneth Branagh's latest trip into the back catalogue of Agatha Christie. And I've got to say, I think it's my favourite of what he's done with these kind of murder mysteries. It's darker, it's really stylized as well, and I think the work that him and Hilda have done on this is brilliant. It's out in cinemas this Friday, the 15th of September, so it's well worth seeing, and what's well worth listening to as well is our conversation with Hilda next week on Soundtracking. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.